Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your guest host, Britton Devereaux, CEO for D'Amore Healthcare. If you or a loved one are struggling with an addiction, with mental illness, please call us today at D'Amore Healthcare, 714-375-1110. D'Amore Healthcare is your resource for subacute psychiatric care. We provide a unique form of compassion that we call gracious redundancy. And together, our team is changing the landscape of psychiatry. We are licensed to treat mental illness. We are licensed to treat co-occurring disorders. And we invite you to call us at 714-375-1110 or visit our website at www.damorehealthcare.com. Every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific Standard Time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to life today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addiction, optimizing our life experience, and so much more. I'm sure many of you expected to hear Alan's voice this morning. We are reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. As a licensed private investigator and crisis interventionist, he gets calls and he has to respond quickly. And I believe today he's in Stockholm, Sweden. Be it locating a runaway, escorting a team to a specialized program, retrieving an abducted child, or meeting with government officials from around the country, I know he is focusing on making a positive difference all across the world. Of course, I wish him swift success in whatever endeavor he is responding to today. I want to first invite everybody to welcome Aaron to the show. Aaron Thompson is the Special Projects Manager for the Inner City Law Center on Skid Row within Los Angeles. She's responsible for Homeful LA, and she's here today to tell us about an event that's occurring here in LA County on October 4th, 5th, and 6th. And it's so that we can all participate in ending the homelessness crisis in LA. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me, and hats off to you, Alan, wherever you are in the world. We love you and we appreciate you.
We sure do.
I'm really excited to be here to just tell all the listeners about a LA County event that's coming up on October 4th through the 6th. That's almost a little bit over a month away. We'll have 8 different events that Friday, Saturday, and Sunday all throughout the county. We're splitting it up between 8 spas. That's the way that the county splits itself geographically. So it'll be 8 events, one in your neighborhood that is for the community. It's for people who really care about the homelessness crisis. It's for people who are tired of just walking past and really want to make a difference but don't know what they can do. We're going to have resources there and service providers. We're even going to have some entertainment and artistic displays of from people who have experienced homelessness before so that you can really get to know them on a different level and see them from a different perspective. But we're really proud of the work that we've been doing as a service provider. Inner City Law Center services clients who are experiencing homelessness or are on the verge of homelessness in a legal capacity. But we also have a policy team that has been working on things like Measures H and HHH. And if you go to our website, homeful.la, you'll see on our advocacy page the important policy measures that are coming up that we need your support with. So be sure to plug in and stay up to date on what's going on with the events there at homeful.la, HOMEFUL.LA.
Okay, Aaron, so that's all very, very helpful for us. Tell us how we can plug into either social media or any other way to spread the word. Give us 2 or 3 steps of how we can invite others to really make an impact related to homelessness and the crisis that we're facing in LA.
Well, we definitely have a presence and promote different opportunities for people to either volunteer, advocate, or donate towards ending homelessness right on the website. We also are contactable and accessible on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. We need more YouTube followers. We're kind of sad on YouTube, but hopefully
you guys
will tune in and even send us content about what you guys are doing in the community. We have a we're accepting artistic expressions of people who care about the homelessness crisis now through our website as well. So that's a new creative way for people to get involved.
Outstanding. I also want to welcome Rob Danson, also a guest co-host this morning. He is head of marketing and communications for Food on Foot. Rob focuses his efforts on a nonprofit that empowers homelessness, providing full-time employment, permanent housing, and food. Rob, tell us a little bit more about Food on Foot and welcome this morning.
Oh, thank you so much. Definitely honored to be here. So Food on Foot is a nonprofit organization that's been helping our homeless neighbors here in Los Angeles for about 23 years now. And we have two main programs. The first program is our Sunday Meals program, where we have volunteers that can sign up on our website at foodonfoot.org. And they can distribute food and clothing to approximately 150 homeless and low-income individuals every single Sunday in Hollywood. In addition to our food serving, we also have a much larger jobs and housing program. The end goal is self-sufficiency. So we help homeless people earn their way out of homelessness. We find them a full-time job, their own fully furnished apartment, and we give them what's called as a life skills education along the way.
Okay, and what happens on Sundays?
So on Sundays, that's really when the two main programs come together. So every Sunday from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock, volunteers can distribute food and clothing. And during that time, in addition to just distributing food, they get to learn about our larger jobs and housing program. And we have a lot of current participants and even graduates that volunteer their time. Graduates from that program, and they'll come and talk to the volunteers about where they are, how they became homeless, where they are now with a full-time job in their own apartment, and really what volunteers can do to help expand that programming as well.
Okay. And if I remember right, 85% of your graduates are still fully employed. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So we work on a model that we like to call trust first. And what that really is really instilling trust within our homeless clients, not only within themselves, but also with the organization as well. So trust within themselves is really working on their self-esteem, their confidence. For many people that end up on the streets, one of the first things to go is their self-esteem. And that can really create a downward spiral into chronic homelessness. And so what we like to do is we like to catch these people before they really slip into chronic homelessness. And so during this time that they're working on building up their trust, we give them what is called as a life skills education. This is anything from mock interview training for the jobs that we will end up helping them find, crisis management, money management, and we also have them give back to the community. They're all involved in volunteer efforts on their own, where they clean up the streets of Hollywood in exchange for food gift cards, but also to instill more of this sort of life skills education. Once they're about halfway through the program, they receive their own fully furnished apartment and a full-time job. At this time, they're still in the program, and they start to receive a paycheck like they would normally do at a full-time job. The only difference is that they give us their paychecks. Now, we do not cash it. We do not spend it. We just basically save it for them. And while they're giving us their paychecks, we provide everything they need to survive. So we give them a bus pass, a cell phone, food gift cards. Their apartment is completely fully furnished. And once they accumulate about $5,000 worth of paycheck savings, they then graduate the program.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for telling us about Food on Foot and how we can help out with the event that's coming up. First of all, as somebody that engages mental illness on a daily basis, I am deeply indebted to the work that you're both doing, not just how it's affecting LA County, but all of us in California. So, Rob, Aaron, thank you. And thank you for staying in the studio with us today to guest co-host. And without further ado, I want to introduce our topic for today. The topic of today's show is also the topic of the book that the author is sharing with us today, Carrie Driscoll, One Teenager at a Time, Developing Self-Awareness and Critical Thinking in Adolescence. Carrie is a child of the 70s and a Pacific Northwest native. She has been described as a tree-hugging, granola-eating idealist and takes it as a compliment. She writes about social justice, parenting, mindfulness, food, and her family with their permission. Mm-hmm. After completing degrees in biology, philosophy from Pacific University in Oregon, she went on to work in various healthcare settings before realizing writing was the most compelling activity she could imagine doing. She founded the Self Project in 2015 to share her adolescent social-emotional health curriculum with educators and parents. Carrie also writes on her personal blog at www.the-writing-life.blogspot.com. Carrie, I want to welcome you to the show, and you can probably share that URL without the pause that I had in there. Welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited.
We're excited to talk about your book today, One Teenager at a Time. So tell us, when you think about developing self-awareness and critical thinking in adolescence, what's one thing that you want listeners to know about today as we start to look at your book and the curriculum and your passion today?
I guess one thing that I really want to share is that I think that teenagers are sort of stigmatized and they get kind of a bad rap. Teenagers are actually my favorite human beings because they have this amazing ability to have a foot in both worlds simultaneously. And I think we also need to realize what a struggle that is, that there's so much happening beneath the surface with kids this age that we need to really give them credit for being able to function as well as they are. And I think the more that adults can understand the social development and the brain development that's happening, the better we can help them equip themselves to be resilient, to create community, and to make really good decisions as a way to creating a path forward that is really positive and successful for them, whatever success means to them.
That's awesome, Carrie. This is Erin, and I used to run a project called the S-Word Project, and we would do after-school curriculum for teens to talk to them about sex and relationships. I wonder, since you've been delivering this curriculum to your teens, what are the major issues that you're seeing that come up over and over again that you've incorporated in your curriculum to solve?
One of the basic pieces of my curriculum is really, it's really designed on facilitating conversations and letting teenagers talk and build community among themselves. I think, unfortunately, that our education system is set up as this very transactional thing where the teacher is sort of the deliverer of information and we expect kids to be passive recipients. And what I've realized over the years is that teenagers really have a lot to say, but they don't have a lot of people that are willing to listen really very deeply and try to understand. And I think that the more opportunities we give kids to have difficult conversations with each other and to really, really be heard, the more they come out of their shell and the more they realize they actually do have something to say that's valuable and valid.
That's awesome.
So your introduction, you referenced a little bit about brain development, and I would love to unpack that a little bit more. Can you tell us about the research that you referenced in the book?
Sure. I'm not a brain researcher. My background is in biology. I had a minor in chemistry, but then also philosophy. So I do have a scientific background, and I worked for the state of Washington mental health division for several years in their adolescent inpatient psychiatric facilities. And so I've always been really fascinated by that. A lot of the research that has come out of, especially Dr. Dan Siegel, what he's done in the last decade or so, looking at the really rapid brain development and the kinds of unique attributes of the adolescent brain, really was exciting for me, because that was around the same time that I was starting to look at mindfulness and nonviolent communication. And what it really drove home to me was the amount of work that's happening in the adolescent brain. I mean, we've known for a really long time as educators that adolescents are able to stop being such concrete thinkers and be able to, you know, understand more abstract concepts. And what folks like Dr. Dan Siegel have really capitalized on in their research is looking at how that changes the brain and how it shapes it for really the rest of our lives. And so it's exciting to me to know how to help adolescents capitalize on what's happening already in their brains to make them work more efficiently and effectively.
Sure. And when Rob was sharing a little bit about his efforts with Food on Foot, and when Aaron was sharing a little bit about Homeful LA, the thing that of course comes to my mind is that there are things that we can do to prevent mental illness, or at least the continuation of the process. So can you speak a little bit to the process that you recommend parents, families listening today to engage as they think about that social and emotional impact of environment, or how we respond to trauma? We're very much interested in, there's so many people here today doing similar work that ties together. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a couple of the things that we need to really understand is that adolescents are incredibly socially driven, and it's not a frivolous thing, right? When they want to hang out with their friends, when they want to be in constant contact with their friends, when they want to go out and do social things, that's not frivolous. That's biology. We are socially driven creatures. Our brains get, you know, that hit of feel good dopamine when we're around other people that quote unquote get us. So, and for adolescents whose brains are really saturated in emotions, there's a portion of the adolescent brain called the amygdala. And that's the fight or flight section of the brain, for lack of a better explanation. During the period of adolescence, which I generally say is between the ages of 10 and like 22 or 23 years old, the amygdala is physically swollen to 3 times its normal size. So every time people roll their eyes and say, oh my God, you're being dramatic, or, you know, teenagers are so emotional, they literally have no choice. I mean, that's how their brains are wired. And so it's important for us to recognize that that's who they are, and to honor their need for social interaction. Because the other piece of that is, when you're so emotionally driven, if you feel like you don't belong somewhere, that is literally survival for you. You need to survive, or you need to belong to a tribe of some sort in order to survive. That's, you know, goes back to our caveman history, right? And so if you're a teenager who doesn't feel like they belong somewhere, you are literally feeling like you're in fight or flight mode. And that's not being a drama queen. That is literally biochemistry. And so I think that for educators and parents to understand that, and also help teens understand that, you know, don't get down on yourself for feeling this way. This is perfectly normal. once you have that sort of baseline, instead of your emotions or your body being, you know, this horrible villain, you can frame it in an empowering way and say, okay, I know this about myself. And how do I mitigate my response to that?
That's a great description. And just in the title of your book, you talk about self-awareness. And I have to imagine that that connects back to the self-worth that you're pointing to in the unique presentation that an adolescent has in how they're developing, how their amygdala is three times the size, which I had no idea. How self-worth really plays into that in thinking and acting and behaving and connecting in day-to-day life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and that's part of why what I encourage in One Teenager at a Time is that an adult facilitate conversations among teenagers, because that addresses their need for social connection, but it also gives them that really much needed practice of trying out ideas that maybe aren't super popular or having different perspectives. In a place that's sort of a safe place where folks understand, okay, you know, we understand that this is practice. You need to learn how to have difficult conversations. You need to learn how to feel difficult emotions, and you also need to be validated. And so if we can do that in ways where everybody's on an equal footing, then the adolescents begin to see that their voice is important and that it does matter. And then they're more likely to extend that to other portions of their lives where they can advocate for themselves and they will stand up for themselves and they do have a higher sense of self-worth.
What can we take away today thinking about the stress and anxiety facing adolescents today?
You know, it's such a big issue. And I think, you know, there are a lot of things that we can do for that. And one of the most important things is for teenagers to have one or two adults in their lives that treat them with unconditional positive regard. You know, that they know they can go to where there's no judgment. It's not about punishment. There isn't a massive power struggle where I see you and I'm going to help you. I really loved what Rob said about using the model called Trust First. And I really wish that we could get to that point in our schools and our homes with our teenagers, where instead of seeing them as, you know, gaming the system or someone who's trying to be manipulative, if we can trust them first. So I think that's the most important thing. The other important thing, I think, is to educate teenagers. You know, when I've told teenagers about the fact that their amygdala is literally physically swollen to three times its normal size, and it will be for at least a decade, they're shocked, right? But it's a great view into how it's not always going to be this way, and how when you sometimes do react emotionally in a way that feels disproportionate, you can sit with that for a while, or you can go to a safe adult and work on getting some perspective. So I think those things are, you know, just a couple of really important, pretty basic things that we can do for kids who are dealing with a lot of stress and anxiety.
Absolutely. And I noticed One Teenager at a Time also deals with no right or wrong solutions, but instead helps adolescents explore their own values and their own beliefs in a shared space. Can you add to that and share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's incredibly difficult, especially as a parent, right? A lot of us see our kids as mini versions of ourselves, or we're parenting them through the lens of the way that we were parented. And that's absolutely natural and normal. But it's also important to recognize that what we truly, really want for our kids is to become their own people. And, you know, I've met a lot of teenagers along the way who haven't had an opportunity to explore their own value systems, or, you know, they've never really been asked, what is it that makes you tick? What are you passionate about? And then there are other kids who have thought about that, but who haven't been allowed an opportunity to express that. And I think if we're being honest as parents and educators, what we really want is for our kids to know who they are and live that life that's going to make them happy. But unfortunately, we don't always set systems up like that as parents because we're afraid. You know, we're afraid to let them have that kind of freedom because, especially now, the world is so competitive. You have to have certain SAT scores. You have to have a certain number of hours of community service. You have to have these extracurriculars. You have to go to college, right? So it's definitely difficult to strike that balance. But the earlier we can help teens begin to understand that they have a right to have their own perspective, that they have a right to own their own values and really express those and play, right? That's the other thing about those teenage years is we're also biologically designed to try on lots of different identities. And that's okay because that's how we figure out who we want to be as an adult.
It's interesting because it takes such risk to engage in honest exchange. And so often in the educational setting or in a setting at home with one's family, an honest exchange is going to threaten somebody. And so what I like about One Teenager at a Time is that there's different lessons that are addressing social and emotional health. And whether that conversation is initially too risky for some members of the family, really, we can just take and literally set fear on the shelf while we take one risk together as a family unit. So can you talk a little bit about the lessons from the book?
Sure, absolutely. The book is divided into different sections. And so there's a section on mindfulness. There's a section on compassion. There's one on positive mindset, one on self-worth. And then the last chapter is on stress, anxiety, and fear. And every lesson was designed to be fairly flexible. They're all sort of structured in the same way, but it's not one of these things where, you know, you have to sit down and do the whole thing all at once. In fact, I kind of prefer that they get spread out over a couple of days, especially for folks who tend to be a little bit more introverted or who are somewhat paralyzed by fear. You know, if you give them a couple of days to think about something in a different way, they might come back with a different answer. So there really are just discussion prompts in each lesson. So it'll start with sort of a quick story or an anecdote. And then the idea is to just really launch into a discussion. And there are a couple of questions that I'll use in there to sort of prompt the discussion. But the goal is really to just have everybody feel like this is a safe space where they can have a conversation that really expresses what they're thinking in the moment, even if that's fear. I mean, that's part of developing self-awareness, right? Is to be able to feel that feeling in your body. And instead of shutting down the conversation, be able to say to those other people, this is kind of scary. So then after the discussion, there's a little activity for the folks who tend to learn a little bit more kinesthetically as opposed to just verbal or auditory. There's an activity that's related to that particular topic. And then each lesson finishes with a 3 to 5 minute guided meditation or visualization that hopefully sort of sinks part of that discussion and the lesson just really down into each individual person and creates a space for it to just really settle into your bones so that you can kind of absorb and reflect on what it is that you just talked about.
Okay. I want to thank everybody who has joined us so far on the show. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Carrie Driscoll, who's talking about One Teenager at a Time.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
We're back. I'm joined by Rob Danson, who is representing Food on Foot. He oversees marketing and communications, and joined by Aaron Thompson, the Special Projects Manager for Inner City Law Center, and of course, our guest today, Carrie Driscoll.
Hey, Carrie. I have a quick question for you. I've been meditating for a while now, and I have a lot of friends that are, you know, practicing mindfulness and meditation. And the one common theme that I hear with my friends, and also that I feel with myself as well, is that, you know, meditation is actually a pretty hard thing to kind of tackle, because your thoughts are always kind of running around in your head. And I'm curious to know what it's like for adolescents to meditate. Do you feel that they can? It's easier for them to become really mindful and to really focus on their breathing and not kind of have their thoughts get in the way.
I wouldn't say it's easier. I've been meditating for about 15 years, and I still have days where I, you know, feel like I have that super active, crazy mind. That's part of the reason that I created the guided meditations in my book, is because I find it sometimes easier, especially in the middle of a busy day where, I mean, if think about teenagers, right? They have 6 or 7 or 8 different classes a day that they're expected to get to. Most of them are playing a sport or an instrument or working part-time, or, you know, there's all these other things they have happening. And so I find that with most teenagers, doing a guided meditation or a visualization is easier for them, because it gives you that one focal point, as opposed to the traditional meditation, which is do a body scan or focus on your breath. The bonus, I think, of teaching teenagers mindfulness meditation is that we're creating neural pathways during those teenage years that will make it easier and more likely for them to use mindfulness meditation as a tool as they get older. And that's the beauty, the most beautiful thing about the adolescent brain, is they're pruning away old connections, neural connections that aren't really necessary, and they're further solidifying new ones, kind of almost creating superhighways in their brains to make their brains work more efficiently. And so if we can capture that when they're in their teenage years and really set down that superhighway toward, if I'm dealing with stress, or, you know, or even just on a, if I know that setting myself up for success means meditating for 15 minutes every morning when I get up, if we can teach them that when they're teenagers, then they're way more likely to use that as a go-to tool when they're in their 30s and 40s and 50s.
I could definitely see your work, and thank you for the work that you're doing. This is amazing. I could definitely see this being used even in the work that me and Rob do, as it relates to transitional age youth who are experiencing homelessness. There are lots of organizations that promote their volunteer and donation opportunities on our site on homeful.la, and I could see how teaching them mindfulness and meditation and just creating safe spaces where they can be heard, you know, would be, I mean, after you've experienced the trauma of ending up in homelessness, I know that's there's a need for something like this. So I would definitely invite you to reach out to service providers and tell them about your book as well.
And Carrie, you mentioned about
this. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You mentioned that the
sorry, go ahead.
No problem. You mentioned that the book can be used in the homeroom. So to Erin's point, there's lots of deliveries for this. This content is so important. I think about our work every day at D'Amore Healthcare, trying to set the tone for an individual to understand self-compassion, that then with that, they can achieve so many other things in society and from their mindfulness and self-worth. So I love what you're doing. And when I think about it, there's lots of ways we can use it in the marketplace. So can you speak to the educator that would want to use this in the homeroom?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I really push a lot is that, you know, this work can't be done in a vacuum. It needs to be done in all the spaces where teenagers actually are, so that everybody, all the adults around them that care for them, are delivering a consistent message and reinforcing the same ideas. And the reason that I like the idea of it being done in a homeroom or an advisory period is, you know, especially when kids get to middle and high school, they may have sort of 10 different teachers, right? But if you have that one consistent teacher who you interact with on almost a daily basis, and if you're in a homeroom where it's the same congregation of kids, but it's hopefully not a homogenous group of kids, this is the perfect opportunity to set that norm of everybody has a voice. This is a safe space. And let's practice having conversations about difficult things to normalize it and see what happens. It's kind of magical. So, and I think that, you know, if we've got parents and youth group leaders and social workers and school counselors and teachers and coaches and mentors who are all using something like one teenager at a time and understand the way that it works and adolescent development and how to support these young people, then that's how we're going to have a really big impact, I think.
I agree. And what would a student-driven conversation around this look like, Carrie?
You know, it can look really different depending on who you're working with. That's one of the things that I learned early on when I was sort of piloting the program. I worked with a group of students from the Seattle Girls School, which is a private school, but it's very socioeconomically diverse. About 40 to 50% of their girls are on scholarship at any given time. And it's right in the heart of the Central District in Seattle, so also culturally diverse. I piloted the project in Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was very, very different from Seattle. And then I worked with an alternative public high school in Seattle called the Recovery School for students with addiction issues. And I have to say, there's no one conversation, even in the same lesson, it's going to go exactly the same, because, and that's the beauty of it for me as a facilitator, is, you know, these kids are going to talk about the things that are closest to them, that are most important to them. And those are the things they need to be talking about. And so it's really amazing to see, you know, like a lot of the kids with addiction issues had really a pretty severe history of trauma. And one of the things that they really talked about was dissociating from their bodies. And so when we tried to use mindfulness that brought them into their bodies, that was really, really difficult. And it was also, if we were patient and willing to do the hard work, the most impactful work. You know, for the girls at the Seattle Girls School, one of the most impactful conversations we had was around gang violence and, you know, the police brutality and, you know, the shootings of people of color by police. And that didn't happen in Arkansas. We didn't have that conversation in Arkansas. We had conversations about poverty and what it's like to be raised by someone who isn't your biological parent. So the conversations all look very different. They're all very unique to the groups of people that are having them. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about this work, is that this curriculum is not a one-size-fits-all, and there are no right or wrong answers. It's just about encouraging these kids to have conversations with each other that give each other better perspectives on what's actually going on beneath the surface in their lives.
Carrie, you used a phrase that I want to make sure that the listeners understand. You mentioned disassociating, and you talked about how mindfulness can bring them back to their bodies. Can you tell us a little bit how taking some time with one teenager at a time would help parents, would help students, would help community members today to look at fear and anxiety with maybe a different lens to help bring people back to their bodies and treat fear and anxiety in a way that can impact their mental health today and maybe even address addiction today?
Sure. And I will preface all of that by saying that, you know, this is a really, really tricky thing, and it's absolutely not a substitute for professional counseling, you know, individual therapy. You know, for folks who've had especially trauma in their history, being in your body can sometimes be just incredibly scary. And that, again, is because of the way that we're wired. You know, our bodies go into fight or flight, but sometimes they go into complete dissociation, which is, you know, for people who maybe eat their feelings or decide that they need to start popping Xanax or doing different kinds of drugs, it's because being in your body is so incredibly uncomfortable. That is because, you know, that our gut is so linked to our brain. And when we have these really scary or unpleasant sensations or situations that we're in, and we know we can't fight our way out of it, our bodies tend to shut down. And if they don't shut down on their own, we want to shut them down. And so maybe I'm going to drink a fifth of tequila, or I'm going to pop some pills, or I'm going to smoke something so that I can get out of my body. I think it's important for us to know that that's not a moral failing. That's actually sort of a pretty reasoned response, especially if you don't understand that you have other options and you can be in a safe place. Unfortunately, it becomes habitual for a lot of people. And so one of the things that's really important is to educate folks about, you know, your body was trying to protect you, and what you did was understandable, and there are better ways to do that. So we need to create safe places and use baby steps to get people to get back into their bodies. And if we can do that with mindfulness, then we can teach them over time that your body is actually a pretty phenomenal place. It's a pretty amazing machine, and it's not a scary place. And you can see it as a champion for you instead of something that's sabotaging you or something that you can't wait to get away from.
In your book, Carrie, you mention the protective factors for healthy families. So I want to address that as well, because I think that has a lot to do with families, schools, community members addressing self-awareness and critical thinking in adolescents in a very inclusive way. So thinking about those protective factors, can you share a little bit more about them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you know, a lot of us as parents, we parent our kids in reaction to the way that we were parented. And there's so much stress on families and educators now to do so many things and there are only so many hours in a day that we end up reverting back to, you know, our habitual responses. And so one of the things as parents and educators that we can do is really do some of this work for ourselves and become a little bit more self-aware and a little bit more mindful. You know, what are our goals here? What is it that we're trying to achieve? How can we maintain relationship with our students and our children? And in doing so, how can we create a culture of open conversation and honesty and vulnerability, even when it's difficult? You know, how can we agree to dig in when somebody wants to run away? And then also creating a culture where as our kids get older, they feel like the balance of power shifts more and more so that their voice is important and it is heard. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to agree with it at all times. I don't agree with my teenagers at all times, but we do have to allow space for them to exist the way that they exist.
And as a mother, thinking about the idea that you talked about earlier about story, how does leading with stories impact the way that teenager could engage?
I think in a couple different ways. First and foremost, you know, not to harken back too much to the brain development, but our brains love story. We actually get a dopamine hit when a story is completed. You know, whether that's putting together a puzzle and you put the last piece in, or watching or reading a mystery novel and finally figuring out who did it. Our brains are wired to have answers. We want answers. And story is a really great way to begin something. But if you don't have the answer, then we're compelled to examine that. We're compelled to play with it. We're compelled to think about it. And so if we can start with story and leave people with a little bit of a question, then our chances of engaging folks in discussion are amazing, because everybody wants to kind of dig in and go, wait, 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 but what if, or how about, or maybe it should end this way. And so it's a great way to grab people's attention. And teenagers in particular like to contradict. They want to play devil's advocate. And so it's a great way to engage them in discussion.
I find that really fascinating. And I see that come up in the work that we do with teens and also with homelessness, that people respond to authenticity, like to people really being raw and transparent, really sharing what's going on. And I think a lot of times us as adults, we kind of want to look as if we have it all together, and we fall into that trap of even lying or just leaving a lot of details out. But I think even when you share generally with teens and just let them know that you were once a teen and you still experience, you know, trauma or make mistakes, but you find ways to overcome that and still manage to be able to enjoy life and be of service to others, and that's what's not being taught in school. So it's great that we have this tool now.
And Carrie, I want to point out
that, I think it is. Ahead, it's really important to let kids know that we're adults, but we're not infallible.
Right. They definitely respond to that and then get a whole new, you know, it just opens up their world, you know, to be able to say that, you know, I'm going to get through this. I have a support system and people that understand what I'm going through and want to be there for me.
Yeah.
So often, Carrie, I hear family members speak about they wish they would have known this about how to help their loved one. They wish that they would have intervened earlier. They wish, right? And so thinking about self-awareness and critical thinking and the key points that you've mentioned this morning about a positive mindset, fear, stress, compassion, mindfulness, I invite families to pick up your book, One Teenager at a Time, Developing Self-Awareness and Critical Thinking in Adolescence, again by our guest today, author Carrie Driscoll. It is an honor to talk with you through some of the things that are so needed in the marketplace, in the classroom, and at the dinner table. And one of those things that I think is extremely important that we all forget to talk about is play. So keep on teaching us what to do, because honestly, Carrie, your work is impacting all the three of us here today and all of our listeners. So thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I'm so excited about what you all are doing down in LA too. So keep doing what you're doing. And thanks again for having me on to talk about the book.
And to everybody, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we'll be replaying one of our most popular interviews with Dr. Elson Haas to discuss staying healthy with new medicine, integrating natural, Eastern, and Western approaches. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, YouTube, and our latest platform, iHeartRadio. If you would like to hear more from us, please check us out again at Stitcher or Spreaker or YouTube. And please also, while you're there, leave a review. It would help us so much if you would share this information with others. And again, thank you for joining us today.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.